head on her shoulder, a one-sided embrace. She brought me into this world. I will help her leave it. When I am finished, I cradle her in my arms, setting her back gently against the pillow. I pull the sheet up and tuck it beneath her chin. "I love you, Mama," I whisper. The curtain is yanked open, and Adisa stands there. In counterpoint to my quiet grief, she is wailing, sobbing loudly. She throws herself on Mama, clutching fistfuls of the sheet. Like any fire, I know she'll burn out, so I wait until her cries become hiccups. When she turns and sees me standing there, I truly think it's the first time she realizes that I'm even in the room. I don't know if she holds out her arms to me or I hold out my arms to her, but we hold on for dear life. We talk over each other. "Did Mina call you? Had she been feeling poorly? When was the last time you spoke to her?" Shock and anguish run in loop, from me to her and back again. Adisa hugs me tight. My hand tangles in her braids. "I told Wallace Mercy to find himself a new interview subject," she whispers. I draw away just long enough to meet her eye. Adisa shrugs as if I've asked a question.
"You're my only sister," she says.
Mama's funeral is an affair with a capital A, which is exactly how she'd want it. Her longtime church in Harlem is packed with parishioners who have known her for years. I sit in the front row beside Adisa, staring at the giant wooden cross hanging on the chancel wall, between two massive panes of stained glass with a fountain beneath. On the altar is Mama's casket. We got the fanciest one money could buy, which is what Ms. Mina insisted on, and she is the one who is paying for the funeral. Edison stands near Pastor Harold, looking shell-shocked, wearing a black suit that is too short at his wrists and ankles, and his basketball sneakers. He is wearing reflective sunglasses, although we are inside. At first I thought that was disrespectful, but then I realized why. As a nurse, I see death visit all the time, but this is his first experience. He was too little to remember his daddy being sent home in a flag-draped coffin. A long snake of folks shuffles down the aisle, a macabre dance to look in Mama's open casket. She is wearing her favorite purple dress with sequins at the shoulders, and the black patent pumps that made her feet hurt, and the diamond studs that Ms. Mina and Mr. Sam gave her one year for Christmas that she never wore because she was too afraid one would fall out and she would lose it. I wanted to bury her in her lucky scarf, but in spite of turning her apartment upside down, I could not find it to bring it to the undertaker. "She looks like she's at peace," I hear over and over. Or, "She looks just like herself, don't she?" Neither one of these is true. She looks like an illustration in a book, two-dimensional, when she ought to be leaping off the page. When everyone has had a chance to file by, Pastor Harold starts the service. "Ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, this is not a sad day," he says. He smiles gently at my niece Tiana, who is sobbing into little Zanisa's tiny Bantu knots. "This is a happy day, for we are here to celebrate our beloved friend and mother and grandmother, Luann Brooks, who is finally at peace and walking beside the Lord. Let us begin with prayer." I bow my head, but sneak a glance around the church, which groans at the seams with well-wishers. They all look like us, except for Ms. Mina and Christina, and in the back, Kennedy McQuarrie and an older woman. It surprises me to see her here, but then, of course, she knows about Mama. I was at her house when I heard. Still, it feels like a blurred line, like wine and cheese at her home was. Like I am trying to put her in a box and she keeps escaping the confines. "Our friend Luann was born in 1940, the pastor says, to Jermaine and Maddie Brooks, the youngest of four. She had two daughters and made the best of her life after their daddy left, raising them to be good, strong women. She devoted her life to serving others, creating a happy home for the family that employed her for over 50 years.
She won more ribbons at our church fair for her pies and cakes than anyone else in this congregation, and I do believe that at least 10 pounds around my middle can be credited to Lou's sweets. She loved gospel music, and the view, and baking, and Jesus, and is survived by her daughters and her 6 beloved grandchildren. The choir sings Mama's favorite hymns. Take my hand, precious Lord, and I'll fly away. Then the pastor returns to the podium. He lifts his eyes to the congregation. God is good, he calls. All the time, everyone responds. And he has called his angel home to glory. After a round of amens, he invites those so moved to stand and witness the impact Mama made on their lives. I watch some of her friends get up, moving slowly, as if they know they might be next. She helped me through breast cancer, one says. She taught me how to sew a hymn. She never lost at bingo. It is illuminating. I knew Mama in one way, but to them, she was something different. A teacher, a confidant, a partner in crime. As their stories shape who Mama used to be, people are crying, rocking, calling out their praise. Adisa squeezes my hand and takes to the podium. My mama, she says, was strict. The crowd laughs at this truth. She was strict about manners and homework and dating and how much bare skin we could show when we went out in public. There was a ratio, right, Ruth? It changed depending upon the season, but it cramped my style year-round. Adisa smiles, faintly, turning into herself. I remember how once she put out a place setting at the dinner table for my attitude, and she told me, girl, when you leave the table, that can stay behind. Oh, yes, she did, I hear behind me. The thing is, I was a wild child. Maybe I still am. And Mama rode us on things that other parents never seemed to care about. At the time, it seemed so unfair. I asked her, what difference would it make in God's grand scheme if I wore a red pleather miniskirt? And she said something I will never forget. Rachel, she told me, I've got precious little time for you to belong to me. I'm gonna make sure it isn't any shorter than it has to be. I was too young and too much of a rabble-rouser to understand what she meant. But now I do. See, what I didn't realize back then was the flip side of that coin. I had precious little time for her to be my mama. Teary, she steps down, and I stand up. To be honest, I didn't know Adisa could be such a good speaker. But then again, she has always been the brave one. Me, I recede into the background. I had not wanted to talk at the funeral, but Adisa said people would be expecting it, and so I did. Tell a story, she suggested. So I take the podium, clearing my throat, and grip the edge of the wood with overwhelming panic. Thank you, I say, and the microphone squeals. I step back. Thank you for coming out to say goodbye to Mama. She would have loved knowing you all cared. And if you hadn't come, you know she'd be up in heaven throwing shade about your manners. I glance out. That was supposed to be a joke, but no one is really laughing. Swallowing, I forge on. Mama always put herself last. You all know that she'd feed anyone and everyone. God forbid you ever left our home hungry. Like Pastor Harold, I bet all of you have had her blue ribbon pies and cakes. Once she was baking a Black Forest cake for a church contest, and I insisted on helping. I was of the age where I was no help at all, of course. At some point, I dropped the measuring spoon into the batter and was too embarrassed to tell her, so it got baked into the cake. When the judge at the contest cut into the cake and found the spoon, Mama knew exactly what had happened. But instead of getting mad at me, she told the judge it was a special trick she used to make the cake moist. You probably remember how the next year, several of the cakes entered in the contest had metal measuring spoons baked inside them. Well, now you know why. There is a titter of laughter, and I let out a breath I had not even realized I'd been holding. I heard people say Mama was proud of her ribbons, of her baking. But you know, that isn't true. She worked hard at that. She worked hard at everything. Pride, she would tell us, is a sin. And in fact, the only thing I ever saw her take pride in was me and my sister. As I say the words, I remember the look on her face when I told her about the indictment. Ruth, she had said when I came home from jail, and she wanted to see me face to face to make sure I was all right. How could this happen to you? I knew what she meant. I was her golden child. I had escaped the cycle. I had achieved. I had busted through the ceiling she spent her life butting her head against. She was so proud of me, I repeat, but the words are viscous, balloons that pop when they hit the air, that leave a faint stench of disappointment. It's all right, baby, I hear from the crowd, and you okay. My mother never said as much, but was she still proud of me? Was it enough that I was her daughter? Or was the fact that I was on trial for a murder I didn't commit like one of those stains she'd worked so hard to get out? There is more to my speech, but it is gone. The words on my little index card might as well be written in hieroglyphs. I stare at them, but nothing makes sense anymore. I can't imagine a world where I might go to prison for years. I can't imagine a world where my mother isn't. Then I remember something she told me once, the night I went to Christina's slumber party. When you're ready for us, we'll be waiting on you. At that moment, I feel another presence I haven't felt before, or maybe one I never noticed. It's solid as a wall and warm to the skin. It's a community of people who know my name, even when I don't always remember theirs. It's a congregation that never stopped praying for me, even when I flew from the nest. It's friends I did not know I had, who have memories of me that I've pushed so far to the back of my mind, I've forgotten. I hear the flow of the fountain behind me, and I think about water, how it might rise above its station as mist, flirt at being a cloud, and return as rain. Would you call that falling or coming home? I don't know how long I stand there weeping. Adisa comes to me, her shawl open like the great black wings of a heron. She wraps me in the feathers of unconditional love. She bears me away. After the choir sings soon and very soon, as the casket is carried from the church and we file out behind it, after the graveside ceremony where the pastor speaks yet again, we reconvene at my mother's apartment, the small space where I grew up. The church ladies have done their duty. There are giant bowls of potato salad and coleslaw and platters of fried chicken set out on pretty pink tablecloths. There are silk flowers on almost every horizontal space, and someone has thought to bring folding chairs, although there isn't nearly enough room for everyone to sit. I take refuge in the kitchen. I look over the stacks of plates of brownies and lemon squares, and then walk to a tiny bookshelf above the sink. There is a small black-and-white composition book there, and I open it, nearly brought to my knees by the spiky hills and valleys of Mama's handwriting. Sweet potato pie, I read. Coconut dreams. Chocolate cake to break a man. I smile at the last recipe. It was what I had cooked for Wesley before he proposed, to which Mama only said, "I told you so." Ruth, I hear. And I turn around to find Kennedy and the other white woman she brought with her looking awkward and out of place in my mama's kitchen. I reach into the abyss and find my manners. Thank you for coming. It means a lot. Kennedy takes a step forward. I'd like you to meet my mother, Ava. The older woman holds out her hand in that southern way, like a limp fish, pressing just the tips of her fingers to the tips of mine. My condolences. It was a lovely service. I nod. Really, what is there to say? How are you holding up? Kennedy asks. I keep thinking Mama's going to tell me to go tell Pastor Harold to use a coaster on her good coffee table. I don't have the words to tell her what it really feels like, seeing her with her own mother, knowing I don't have that option. what it's like being the balloon when someone lets go of the string. Kennedy glances down at the open book in my hands. What's that?
A recipe book. It's only half finished. Mama kept telling me she was going to write down all her best ones for me, but she always was too busy cooking for someone else. I realize how bitter I sound. She wasted her life slaving away for someone else, polishing silver and cooking 3 meals a day and scrubbing toilets so her skin was always raw, taking care of someone else's baby. My voice breaks on that last bit, falls off the cliff. Kennedy's mother, Ava, reaches into her purse.
I asked to come here today with Kennedy, she says. I didn't know your mom, but I knew someone like her, someone I cared for very much.
She holds out an old photo, the kind with scalloped edges. It is a picture of a black woman wearing a maid's uniform, holding a little girl in her arms. The girl has hair as light as snow, and her hand is pressed against her caregiver's cheek in shocking contrast. There's more than just duty between them. There's pride. There's love.
I didn't know your mother, but Ruth, she didn't waste her life.
Tears fill my eyes. I hand the photo back to Ava, and Kennedy pulls me into an embrace. Unlike the stiff hugs I remember from white women like Ms. Mina or my high school principal, this one does not feel forced, smug, inauthentic. She lets go of me so that we are eye to eye.
I am sorry for your loss, Kennedy says,
and something crackles between us. A promise, a hope, that when we go to trial, those same words will not cross her lips.
Kennedy. On my 6th wedding anniversary, Micah gives me the stomach flu. It started last week with Violet, like most transmittable viruses that enter our household. Then Micah began throwing up. I told myself I did not have time to get sick, and thought I was safe until I bolted upright in the middle of the night, bathed in sweat, and made a beeline for the bathroom. I wake up with my cheek pressed against the tile floor, and Micah standing over me. Don't look at me like that, I say, all smug because you've already been through this. It gets better, Micah promises. I moan. Wonderful. I was going to make you breakfast in bed, but instead I opted for ginger ale. You're a prince. I push myself upright. The room spins. Whoa, steady girl. Micah crouches beside me, helping me to my feet. Then he sweeps me into his arms and carries me into the bedroom. In any other circumstance, I say, this would be very romantic. Micah laughs. Rain check. I'm trying really hard not to vomit on you. I can't tell you how much I appreciate that, he says gravely, and he crosses his arms. Would you like to have a fight now about how you're not going into the office, or do you want to finish your ginger ale first? You're using my tactics against me. That's the kind of either-or I offer Violet. See? And you think I never listen. I'm going to work, I say. And I try to get on my feet, but I black out. When I blink a moment later, Micah's face is inches from mine. I'm not going to work, I whisper. Good answer. I already called Ava. She's going to come over and play nurse. I groan. Can't you just kill me instead? I don't think I can handle my mother. She thinks a shot of bourbon cures everything. I'll lock the liquor cabinet. You need anything else? My briefcase? I beg. Micah knows better than to say no to that. As he goes downstairs to retrieve it, I prop myself up on pillows. I have too much to do to not be working. But my body doesn't seem to be cooperating. I drift off in the few minutes it takes Micah to come back into the bedroom. He's trying to gently put the briefcase on the floor so he doesn't disturb me, but I reach for it, overestimating my strength. The contents of the leather folio spill all over the bed and onto the floor, and Micah crouches to pick them up.
Huh,
he says, holding up a piece of paper.
What are you doing with a lab report?
It's wrinkled, having slipped between files to get wedged at the bottom of my bag. I have to squint, and then a run of graphs comes into focus. It's the newborn screening results that I subpoenaed from the Mercy West Haven Hospital, the ones that had been missing from Davis Bauer's file. They came in this week, and given my lack of understanding of chemistry, I barely glanced at the charts, figuring I'd show them to Ruth sometime after her mother's funeral. It's just some routine test, I say.
Apparently not,
Micah replies.
There's abnormality in the blood work.
I grab it out of his hand. How do you know that?
Because, Micah says, pointing to the cover letter I didn't bother to read, it says here there's abnormality in the blood work.
I scour the letter, addressed to Dr. Marlise Atkins. Could it be fatal?
I have no idea.
You're a doctor.
I study eyes, not enzymes.
I look up at him. What did you get me for our anniversary?
I was going to take you out to dinner,
Micah admits. Well, I suggest, take me to see a neonatologist instead. When we say, in America, that you have a right to be tried by a jury of your peers, we're not exactly telling the truth. The pool of jurors is not as random as you'd think, thanks to careful scrutiny by the defense and the prosecution to eliminate both ends of the bell curve, the people most likely to vote against our client's best interests. We weed out the folks who believe that people are guilty until proven innocent, or who tell us they see dead people, or who hold grudges against the legal system because they were once arrested. But we also prune on a case-by-case basis. If my client is a draft dodger, I try to limit jurors who have proudly served. If my client is a drug addict, I don't want a juror who lost a family member to an overdose. Everyone has prejudices. It's my job to make sure that they work in favor of the person I'm representing. So although I would never play the race card once the trial starts, as I've spent months explaining to Ruth, I'm damn well going to stack the odds before it begins. Which is why, before we begin voir dire to choose jurors, I march into my boss's office and tell him I was wrong. I'm feeling a little overwhelmed after all, I say to Harry. I was thinking I might need a co-chair. He takes a lollipop out of a jar he keeps on his desk.
Ed's got a shaken baby trial starting this week.
I wasn't talking about Ed. I was thinking of Howard.
Howard? He looks at me, baffled. The kid who still brings his meals in a lunchbox?
It's true that Howard is fresh out of law school and that so far, in the few months he's been at the office, has only done misdemeanors, domestics, and a few disorderlies. I offer my smoothest grin. Yeah. You know, he'll just be an extra pair of hands for me. A runner. And in the meantime, it would be good for him to get trial experience. Harry unwraps the lollipop and sticks it in his mouth.
Whatever,
he says, his teeth gripped on the stem. With his blessing, or the closest I'm going to get to one, I head back to my cubicle and poke my head over the divider that separates me from Howard. Guess what, I tell him. You're going to second chair the Jefferson case. Voir dire's this week. He glances up.
Wait, what? Really?
It's a big deal for a rookie who is still doing scut work in the office. We're leaving, I announce, and I grab my coat, knowing he will follow. I do need an extra pair of hands. I also need them to be black. Howard scrambles at my side as we walk through the halls of the courthouse. You don't speak to the judge unless I've told you to, I instruct. Don't show any emotions, no matter what theatrical display Odette Lawton puts on. Prosecutors do that to make themselves feel like they're Gregory Peck and Mockingbird.
Who?
God, never mind. I glance at him.
How old are you, anyway? 24?
I have sweaters older than you, I mutter. I'll give you the discovery to read over tonight. This afternoon, I'm going to need you to do some field work.
Field work?
Yeah, you have a car, right? He nods.
And then, once we actually get the jurors inside, you're going to be my human video camera. You're going to record every tick and twitch and comment that each potential juror makes in response to my questions, so that we can go over it and figure out which candidates are going to fuck us over. It's not about who's on the jury, it's about who's not on it. Do you have any questions? Howard hesitates.
Is it true that you once offered Judge Thunder a blowjob?
I stop walking and face him, my hands on my hips. You don't even know how to clean out the coffee machine yet, but you know that. Howard pushes his glasses up his nose.
I plead the fifth.
Well, whatever you heard, it was taken out of context and it was prednisone-induced. Now shut up and look older than 12, for God's sake. I push open the door to Judge Thunder's chambers to find him sitting behind his desk, with the prosecutor already in the room. Your Honor? Hello? He glances at Howard.
Who's this?
My co-counsel, I reply. Odette folds her arms. As of when? About a half hour ago. We all stare at Howard, waiting for him to introduce himself. He looks at me, his lips pressed firmly together. You don't speak to the judge unless I've told you to. Speak, I mutter. He holds out a hand.
Howard Moore, it's an honor, your, honor.
I roll my eyes. Judge Thunder produces a huge stack of completed questionnaires, which are sent out to people who are called for jury duty. They are full of practical information, like where the recipient lives and where he or she works. But they also include pointed questions. Do you have any problems with the presumption of innocence? If a defendant doesn't testify, do you assume he is hiding something? Do you understand that the Constitution gives the defendant the right to not say anything? If the state proves this case beyond reasonable doubt, would you have any moral qualms about convicting the defendant? He splits the pile in half.
Ms. Lawton, you take this bunch for 4 hours, and Ms. McQuarrie, you take these. We'll reconvene at 1 p.m., switch piles, and then voir dire begins in 2 days.
As I drive Howard back to our office, I explain what we are looking for. A solid defense juror is an older woman. They have the most empathy, the most experience, and they're less judgmental, and they're really hard on young punks like Turk Bauer. And beware of millennials.
Why?
Howard asks, surprised.
Aren't young people less likely to be racist?
You mean like Turk? I point out. The millennials are the me generation. They usually think everything revolves around them, and make decisions based on what's going on in their lives and how it will affect their lives. In other words, they're minefields of egocentrism.
Got it.
Ideally, we want a juror who has a high social status because those people tend to influence other jurors when it comes to deliberations.
So we're looking for a unicorn,
Howard says.
A super-sensitive, racially conscious, straight white male.
He could be gay, I reply, serious. Gay, Jewish, female, anything that can help them identify with discrimination in any form is going to be a bonus for Ruth.
But we don't know any of these candidates. How do we become psychic overnight?
We don't become psychic. We become detectives, I say. You're going to take half the surveys and drive to the addresses that are listed on them. You want to find out whatever you can. Are they religious? Are they rich? Poor? Do they have political campaign signs on the lawn? Do they live above where they work? Do they have a flagpole in the front yard?
What does that have to do with anything?
More often than not, that's someone who's extremely conservative, I explain.
Where are you going to be?
He asks. Doing the same thing. I watch Howard leave, plugging the first address into his phone GPS. Then I wander the halls of the office asking other public defenders if they've had any of these folks on their panels. A lot of the jurors get recycled. Ed is about to head out the door to court, but he glances at the sheaf of papers.
I remember this guy,
he says, pulling one survey free.
He was part of my jury on Monday. Grand larceny case. He raised his hand during my opening statement and asked if I had a business card.
Are you kidding me?
Sadly,
Ed says.
No. Good luck, kiddo.
10 minutes later, I've plugged an address into my GPS and find myself driving through Newhallville. I lock the doors for safety's sake. Presidential Gardens, the apartment building between Shelton and Dixwell Avenues, is a lower-income pocket of the city, with a quarter of the residents living below the poverty line, and the streets that bracket the residences are rife with drug traffic. Nevia Jones lives in this building somewhere. I watch a little boy run out the door of one building, not wearing a coat, and start jogging when the cold hits him. He wipes his nose on his sleeve in mid-stride. Will a woman from this area see Ruth and think she is being railroaded? Or will she see the socioeconomic difference between them and be resentful? It's a hard call. In Ruth's unique case, the best juror may not be the one with the same color skin. I put a question mark at the top of the survey. This one I'll have to consider further. Driving slowly out of the neighborhood, I wait until I see children playing outside and then pull over to the curb and call Howard's cell. So? I ask when he picks up. How's it going? He says.
I'm sort of stuck.
Where?
East Shore.
What's the problem?
It's a gated community. There's a low fence and I could look over it, but I'd have to get out of the car.
Howard says. Then get out of the car.
I can't. See, back when I was in college, I kind of made a rule for myself. Don't get out of the car unless there's a happy living black person in sight.
He exhales.
I've been waiting for 45 minutes, but the only people in this part of New Haven are white.
That's not necessarily a bad thing for Ruth. Can't you just go peek over the wall? Make sure she doesn't have a Trump sign on her lawn?
Kennedy, there are neighborhood watch signs all over the place. What do you think is going to happen if they see a black man trying to peek over a wall?
Oh, I say, embarrassed. I get it. I look out the window to where three kids are jumping into piles of leaves. I think of the little black boy I saw streaking away from Presidential Gardens. Ed told me last week that he defended a 12-year-old involved in a gang shooting with two 17-year-olds, and that the prosecution was gunning to have all three tried as adults. Give me an hour and then meet me at 560 Theodore Street in East End. And Howard, when you arrive, it's safe to get out of the car, I say. I live there. I lightly drop the bag of Chinese food onto the desk of my home office. I have goodies, I say, taking out the lo mein and laying claim to it.
So do I,
Howard says, and he points to a stack of papers he's printed out. It's 10 p.m., and we've set up camp at my home. I left Howard there all afternoon to do online research while Odette and I swapped stacks of surveys. For hours, I've battled traffic, sussed out more jurors by neighborhood, and scanned the plaintiff and defendant lists at the courthouse to see if any of the potential jurors have been criminally prosecuted or have relatives that were criminally prosecuted. I found three guys who were charged with domestics, a woman whose mother got convicted of arson, and a lovely little old lady whose grandson's meth lab was busted last year,
Howard announces. The screen reflects, glowing green around Howard's face as he scans the page.
Okay,
he says, opening a plastic container of soup and drinking from the side without a spoon.
God, I'm starving. So here's the thing. You can get some good dirt on Facebook, but it depends on privacy settings.
Did you try LinkedIn?
Yeah, he says. It's a gold mine.
He beckons me to the floor, where he's spread out the surveys and has paperclipped printouts to each one.
This guy, we love him, Howard says. He's a social justice educator at Yale. And even better, his mother is a nurse.
I hold up my hand. He high-fives.
This is my second favorite.
He passes me the survey. Candace White. She's 48 years old, African-American, a librarian, mother of three. She looks like someone who could be friends with Ruth, not just rule in favor of the defense. Her favorite TV show is Wallace Mercy. I may not want Reverend Mercy messed up in Ruth's case, but the people who watch him are definitely going to have sympathy for my client. Howard is still listing his finds.
I've got three ACLU memberships, and this girl ran a whole tribute to Eric Garner on her blog, a series called I Can't Breathe Either.
Nice,
On the other end of the spectrum, Howard says, this lovely gentleman is the deacon of his church and also supports Rand Paul and advocates the repeal of all civil rights laws.
I take the survey from his hand and put a red X through the name at the top.
Two people who posted about reducing funding for welfare, Howard says. I'm not sure what you want to do about that.
Put them in the middle pile, I reply.
This girl updated her status 3 hours ago. Jesus Christ, some chink just sideswiped my car.
I place her survey on top of the Rand Paul advocates, as well as someone whose profile pic on Twitter is Glenn Beck. There are two candidates Howard has nixed because they liked Facebook pages for Skullhead and Day of the Sword. Is that some Game of Thrones thing? I ask, baffled.
They're white power bands, Howard says,
and I am pretty sure he blushes.
I found a group called Vaginal Jesus, too, but none of our potential jurors listened to them.
Thank God for small mercies.
What's the big pile in the middle? Indeterminate,
Howard explains.
I have a few pictures of people making gun gang signs, a handful of stoners, one idiot who took a video of himself shooting up heroin, and 30 selfies of people who are rocked off their gourd drunk.
Doesn't it just warm the cockles of your heart to know that we entrust the legal system to these folks? I'm joking,
but Howard looks at me soberly. To tell you the truth, today's been a little shocking. I mean, I had no idea how people live their lives, and what they do when they think no one's looking.
He glances at a photo of a woman brandishing a red Solo cup.
Or even when they are.
I spear a Peking ravioli with my chopstick. When you start to see the seedy underbelly of America, I say, it makes you want to live in Canada.
Oh, and there's this,
Howard says, pointing to the computer screen.
Do with it what you will.
He reaches across me for a Peking ravioli. I frown at the Twitter handle, @WhiteMite. Which juror is it?
It's not a juror, he says, and I'm pretty sure Miles Standup is a fake name.
He clicks twice on the profile picture. A newborn infant. Why have I seen that photo before?
Because it's the same picture of Davis Bauer that people were holding up outside the courthouse before the arraignment. I checked the news footage. I think that's Turk Bauer's account.
The internet is a beautiful thing. I look at Howard with pride. Well done.
He looks at me, hopeful, over the white lip of the paper carton. So we're finished for the night?
Oh, Howard, I laugh. We've only just begun. Odette and I meet the next morning at a diner to cross-check the survey numbers of the potential jurors that we each want to decline. In the rare occasion when our numbers match, the 25-year-old who just got out of a psychiatric hospital, the man who was arrested last week, we agree to let them go. I don't know Odette very well. She is tough, no nonsense. At legal conferences, when everyone else is getting drunk and doing karaoke, she is the one sitting in the corner drinking club soda with lime and filing away memories she can use to exploit us later. I've always thought of her as an uptight piece of work. But now I'm wondering, when she goes shopping, is she, like Ruth, asked to show her receipts before exiting the store? Does she mutely hand them over? Or does she ever snap and say she is the one who puts shoplifters on trial? So, in an attempt to offer an olive branch, I smile at her. It's going to be quite a trial, huh? She stuffs her folder of surveys into her briefcase.
They're all big trials.
But this one, I mean... I stumble, trying to find the words. Odette meets my gaze. Her eyes are like chips of flint. My interest in this case is the same as your interest in this case. I am prosecuting it because everyone else in my office is overworked and maxed out and it landed on my desk. And I do not care if your client is black, white, or polka-dotted. Murder is remarkably monochromatic. With that, she stands up. I'll see you tomorrow, Odette says, and she walks away.
Nice chatting with you, too, I mutter.
At that moment, Howard blusters in. His glasses are askew and his shirt is untucked in the back, and he looks like he's already had about 10 cups of coffee.
I was doing some background research,
he begins, sitting down in the chair Odette just vacated. When, in the shower? I know exactly when we stopped working last night, which leaves little room for free time.
So, there was a study done by SUNY Stony Brook in 1991 and 1992 by Nada Turkeldsen about how white voters assess black politicians who are running for office, and how prejudice affects that, and how that changes for people who actively try not to act prejudiced.
First, I say, we are not using a defense based on race. We are using one based on science. Second, Ruth is not running for office.
Yeah, but there are crossover implications in the study that I think could tell us a lot about the potential jurors,
Howard says.
Just hear me out, okay? So Turkeldsen took a random sample of about 350 white people from the jury pool in Jefferson County, Kentucky. She made up three sets of packets about a fake candidate for governor that had the same biography, the same resume, and political platform. The only difference was that in some of the headshots, the candidate was a white man. In others, it was photoshopped to be a light-skinned black man or a dark-skinned black man. The voters were asked to identify if they were racially biased and if they tended to be aware of that racial bias.
I motion with my hands to hurry him up.
The white politician got the most positive responses, Howard says.
Big surprise.
Yeah, but that's not the interesting part. As prejudice increased, the rating of the light-skinned black man dropped quicker than the rating of the dark-skinned black man. But when prejudiced voters were divided into those who were aware of their racism and those who generally weren't, things changed. The people who didn't care if they looked prejudiced were harder on the dark-skinned black man than on the light-skinned black man. The voters who were worried what people would think of them if they were racist, however, rated the dark-skinned black way higher than the light-skinned black. You get it, right? If a white person is trying extra hard to not look racist, they're going to overcompensate for their prejudice by suppressing their real feelings about the darker-skinned person.
I stare at him. Why are you telling me this?
Because Ruth is black. Light-skinned, but still black. And you can't necessarily trust the white people in that jury pool if they tell you they aren't prejudiced. They may be a lot more implicitly racist than they show on the outside. And that makes them wild cards for the jury.
I look down at the table. Odette is wrong. Murder is not monochromatic. We know that from the school-to-prison pipeline. There are so many reasons the cycle is hard to break, and one of them is that white jurors come into a trial with bias. They are far more likely to make concessions for a defendant who looks like them than for one who doesn't.
All right, I say to Howard. What's your plan?
When I crawl into bed that night, Micah is already asleep. But then he reaches out and wraps his arm around me.
No, I say. I am too tired to do anything right now.
Even thank me?
He says. I turn to face him.
Why? Because, he says, I found you a neonatologist.
Immediately I sit up. And?
And we're going to see him this weekend. He's a guy I knew from med school.
What did you tell him?
That my crazy lawyer wife is going all Lysistrata on me until I can get her an expert in the field.
I laugh, then frame Micah's face with my hands and kiss him, long and slow. Go figure, I say. I've gotten my second wind. In one quick move, he grabs me and rolls so that I am pinned beneath him. His smile gleams in the light of the moon.
If you'll do that for a neonatologist, he murmurs, what would you give me if I found you something really impressive, like a parasitologist or a leprologist?
You spoil me, I say, and I pull him down to me. I meet Ruth at the back entrance of the courthouse, just in case Wallace Mercy has decided that jury selection is worth his time and energy. She is wearing a plum suit that I went with her to buy at TJ Maxx last week, and a crisp white shirt. Her hair is pulled back and knotted at the nape of her neck. She looks every inch the professional, and I would have assumed she is at court because she is an attorney, if not for the fact that her knees are shaking so uncontrollably they are knocking together. I take her arm. Relax. Honestly, this isn't worth getting nervous over. She looks at me. It's just suddenly very real. I introduce her to Howard, and as they shake hands, I see something almost imperceptible pass between them. An acknowledgement that it is surprising for both of them to be in this courthouse, for different reasons. Howard and I flank Ruth as we walk into the courtroom and take our seats at the defense table. For all that Judge Thunder is an asshole to us attorneys, juries eat him up. He looks the part, with wavy silver hair and grave lines of experience bracketing his mouth, forming parentheses around whatever wisdom he has yet to speak. When our 100 potential jurors are jammed into the courtroom, he gives preliminary instructions. Remember, I whisper to Howard, leaning behind Ruth's back, your job is to take notes. So many notes that your hand cramps. If one of those jurors flinches at a certain word, I need to know the word. If they fall asleep, I want to know when. He nods as I scan the faces of the potential jurors. I recognize some from their Facebook photos. But even those I don't recall have expressions I am used to seeing. They are the faces of those I secretly call Boy Scouts, who are delighted to be performing this duty to their country. There are the Morgan Stanleys, businessmen who keep checking their watches because their time is clearly more important than spending the day in a jury box. There are the repeat offenders, who have been through this process before and wonder why the hell they've been called again. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm Judge Thunder, and I'd like to welcome you to my courtroom.
Oh, good grief.
In this case, the state is represented by our prosecutor, Odette Lawton. Her job is to prove this case by reason of evidence beyond a reasonable doubt. The defendant is represented by Kennedy McQuarrie.
As he begins to list the charges that Ruth was indicted for, murder and involuntary manslaughter, her knee starts trembling so hard, I reach under the table and press it flat.
I will explain to you later what those charges mean,
Judge Thunder says.
But at this moment, is there any member of the panel who knows the parties in this case?
One juror raises his hand.
Can you approach the bench?
The judge asks. Odette and I move closer for the conference as a noise machine is turned on so that the rest of the jury cannot hear what this guy says. He points to Odette.
She locked up my brother on a drug charge, and she's a lying bitch.
Needless to say, he's excused. After a few more blanket queries, the judge smiles at the group.
All right, folks. I'm going to excuse you, and the bailiff will take you to the jury lounge. We'll be calling you in one at a time so that the counselors can ask some individual follow-ups. Please don't talk about your experiences with your fellow jurors. As I told you, the state has the burden of proof. We haven't started to take evidence yet, so I urge you to keep an open mind and to be honest with your answers in front of the court. We want to make sure you are comfortable sitting as a juror in this case, just as the parties involved have the right to feel that their process can be judged by someone fair and impartial.
If only the judge were the same, I think. Voir dire is a cocktail party without any booze. You want to schmooze your jurors. You want them to like you. You want to act interested in their careers, even if that career is quality control at a Vaseline plant. As each individual juror is paraded before you, you rate him or her. A perfect juror is a 5, a bad juror is a 1. Howard will list the reasons that a juror isn't acceptable so we can keep them straight. Ultimately, we'll wind up taking 3s and 4s and 5s, because we only have 7 peremptory strikes we can use to kick a juror out of the pool without having to give a reason. And we don't want to use those all up at once. Because what if there's a bigger problem juror yet to come? The first man to take the stand is Derek Welsh. He's 58 and has bad teeth and is wearing an untucked plaid shirt. Odette greets him with a smile. Mr. Welsh, how are you doing today?
All right, I guess. A little hungry.
She smiles. Me too. Tell me, have we ever worked on any cases together?
No.
He says. What do you do for a living, Mr. Welsh?
I run a hardware store.
She asks him about his children and their ages. Howard taps me on the shoulder. He's been frantically shifting through the surveys.
This is the one whose brother is a cop, he whispers.
I read the Wall Street Journal, Welsh is saying when I turn back, and Harlan Coben.
Have you heard about this case?
A little bit, on the news,
he admits.
I know the nurse was accused of killing a baby.
Beside me, Ruth flinches. Do you have any opinion about whether the defendant is guilty of that offense? Odette asks.
As far as I know, in our country, everyone's innocent till they're proven guilty.
How do you see your role as a juror? He shrugs.
I guess, listen to evidence and do what the judge says.
Thank you, Your Honor, Odette says, and she sits down. I rise from my seat. Hi there, Mr. Welsh, I say. You have a relative in law enforcement, don't you?
My brother is a police officer.
Does he work in this community?
For 15 years,
the juror replies. Does he ever tell you about his job? What kinds of people he deals with?
Sometimes.
Has your store ever been vandalized?
We were robbed once.
Do you think the increase in crime is due to an influx of minorities in the community? He considers this.
I think it has more to do with the economy. People lose jobs, they get desperate.
Who do you think has the right to dictate medical treatment? The family of the patient or the medical professional? I ask.
It's a case-by-case thing.
Have you or someone in your family had a bad outcome at a hospital? Walsh's mouth tightens.
My mother died on the operating table during a routine endoscopy.
Did you blame the doctor? He hesitates.
We settled.
And a flag is on the field. Thank you, I say. And as I sit down, I look at Howard and shake my head. The second potential juror is a black man in his late 60s. Odette asks him how far he went in school, if he is married, who he lives with, what his hobbies are. Most of these questions are on the survey, but sometimes you want to ask them again, to look the person in the eye when he tells you he does Civil War reenactments, for example, to see if he's just into history or if he's a gun nut. I understand you're a security guard at a mall, she says. Do you consider yourself a member of law enforcement?
I guess in a small sense, he replies.
Mr. Jordan, you know we're looking for an impartial jury, Odette says. It surely has not escaped your notice that you and the defendant are both people of color. Might that impact your ability to make a fair decision? He blinks. After a moment, he replies to Odette.
Is there anything about your color that makes you unfair?
I think Mr. Jordan might be my favorite person in the world right now. I stand up as Odette finishes her questioning. Do you think black people are more likely to commit crimes than white people? I ask. I already know the answer, so that's not why I'm asking. I want to see how he reacts to me, a white woman, posing a question like that.
I believe, he says slowly, that black people are more likely to wind up in jail than white folks.
Thank you, sir, I say, and I turn toward Howard, nodding imperceptibly as if to say, that is a 10. There are several witnesses who fall somewhere in between horrific and perfect, and then juror number 12 takes the stand. Lila Fairclough is the perfect age for a juror, blonde and spry. She teaches in the inner city in a racially integrated classroom. She's very polite and professional with Odette, but she smiles at me the minute I stand up. My daughter is going to be in the school district where you work, I tell her. It's why we moved there. She'll love it, the woman says. Now, here I am, Ms. Fairclough, a white woman representing a black woman who's facing one of the most serious accusations that can be brought against a person. I have some concerns, and I'd like to talk about them because it's just as critical for you to feel comfortable on this jury as it is for me to feel comfortable representing my client. You know, we all talk about prejudice being a bad thing, but it's a reality. For example, there are certain kinds of cases I could never be impaneled on. I mean, I love animals. If I see someone being cruel to them, I can't be objective. I'm just so angry that my anger supersedes any rational thought. If that was the case, I'd have a hard time believing anything the defense told me. I totally get your point, but I don't have a biased bone in my body, Ms. Fairclough assures me. If you got on the bus and there were two seats available, one next to an African-American man and one next to an elderly white woman, where would you sit? In the first available seat. She shakes her head. I know what you're getting at, Ms. McQuarrie, but honestly, I don't have a problem with black people. That's when Howard drops his pen. I hear it like a gunshot. I spin around, meet his eye, and start to fake an Oscar-worthy coughing fit. This was our prearranged signal. I choke as if I am hacking out a lung and drink from the glass of water on the defense table and then rasp at the judge. My colleague will finish up here, Your Honor. When Howard stands up, he starts swallowing convulsively. I'm sure that the judge is going to think the entire defense team has the plague when I see the reaction on Lila Fairclough's face. She freezes the minute Howard steps in front of her. It's infinitesimal, the time between that and how fast she stretches her lips into a smile. But that doesn't mean I haven't witnessed it. I'm sorry, Miss Fairclough, he says. Just a couple more questions. What's the percentage of black children in your classroom? Well, I have a class of 30, and 8 of my children are African-American this year. Do you find that the African-American children have to be disciplined more frequently than the white children? She starts twisting her ring on her finger. I treat all my students equally. Let's step outside of your classroom for a moment. Do you think, in general, that African-American children have to be disciplined more frequently than white kids? Well, I haven't read studies on it. Twist, twist. But I can tell you I'm not part of the problem. Which, of course, means that she thinks there is a problem. When we finish the individual questioning, and the first set of 14 jurors are led back to the holding room, Howard and I huddle together and sort through who, if anyone, we want to strike for cause. Are we ready to discuss excusals? Judge Thunder asks. I'd like to excuse juror number 10, Odette says. The one who indicated that a black person can't get a fair job, let alone a fair trial. No objection, I answer. I'd like to excuse juror number 8, whose daughter was raped by a black man. No objection, Odette says. We excuse a man whose wife is dying, and a mother with a sick baby, and a man who supports his family of 6 and whose boss has told him he cannot miss a week of work without risking his job. I'd like to excuse juror number 12, I say. No way, Odette says. Judge Thunder frowns at me.
You haven't developed a challenge for cause, counselor.
She's racist, I explain, but it sounds ridiculous even to me. The woman teaches black students and swore she wasn't prejudiced. I might know she has implicit bias based on her reaction to Howard and her nervous tick of twisting her ring, but if I explain our little experiment to Odette or the judge, I'll be in trouble. I know if I call her in for further questioning, it won't do any good, which means that I either have to accept her as a juror or must use one of my peremptory strikes. Odette has exercised one strike against a nurse and another against a community organizer who admitted that he can find injustice anywhere. I've dismissed a woman who lost an infant, a man who sued a hospital for malpractice, and one of the guys who, thanks to Howard and Facebook, I know went to a white power music festival. Howard leans across Ruth so he can whisper in my ear.
Use it, he says. She's going to be trouble, even if she doesn't look it.
Counselor, the judge demands, are we all invited to your little gossip session?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. A moment to consult with my co-counsel. I turn back to Howard. I can't. I mean, I have another 86 jurors to get through here and only 4 more strikes. Satan could be part of the next